Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. I'm your host, Marcus Gills, and we are recording live from Banjo, Colorado. Population growing. Welcome to episode number 33 of the Live from Banjo podcast. How is my enchanting co-host, Miss Crystal, doing today?
I'm lovely.
So today's conversation is with Jason Pipkin, a member of one of the best live bands in the world, to grace the stage, The Lone Bellow.
As you said in the interview, really on the Rushmore of singers.
His wife.
Well, yeah, his wife is on the Rushmore of singers, but the band makes up the Rushmore of...
They're like their own separate mountain.
Holy smokes.
So The Lone Bellow, who we saw perform last night at Nashville's Ryman Auditorium at their first headlining show with the Ryman, which is also the famed home of the Grand Ole Opry.
I don't think I quite understand. When I talk about the Ryman, that's what I call it, is the Grand Ole Opry.
A lot of people do.
There was a distinction there where I'm just like, okay, no, the actual auditorium is called the Ryman. It's not called the Grand Ole Opry. Those are two technically separate things.
Correct. But a lot of people do call the Ryman the Grand Ole Opry.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that a lot of people make the same mistakes as me.
Yep. So Jason Pipkin is a singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist who plays keys and bass for The Lone Bellow with his wife, Kaneen Pipkin, who is one of the group's three lead vocalists, mandolin player, and bass player when Jason is on keys. Jason was born in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He met Kaneen at a spelling bee in middle school and grew to know each other much later in life. Jason taught Kaneen to play the bass so she could play with his band. Then subsequently, both ended up in China teaching villages to make and sell bread, hosting an open mic, and teaching music lessons. Ended up in New York with Jason attending seminary and Kaneen going to school to become a pastry chef. Kaneen and Zach had met while singing together at Mike Donahue's wedding, which is Kaneen's brother, and he is also the lead singer and guitar player for the ACC band 10th Avenue North. Jason actually gave Mike guitar lessons prior to his relationship with his sister. Nevertheless, Kaneen, Brian Elmquist, and Zach Williams ended up in New York and ultimately resulted in the band The Lone Bellow. Jason has ended up playing a number of instruments for Lone Bellow since the inception, but now he has ultimately settled into his role as the keys and sometimes swapping bass duties with his wife. Jason and Kaneen are amazing folks, and it was really great to sit down with Jason and discuss his life as a father, musician, and the interesting places his life has taken him. However, music is always and will always have a place in his life. We look forward to continuing to see Jason in The Lone Bellow and whatever solo projects we hope to see him play in and produce in the future. I hope you enjoy the thoughtful words of Jason Pipkin. Thank you so much for everyone that is listening. Please tell your friends, family, and complete strangers about the show. And again, please follow us on Instagram at Live From Banjo Podcast. Find me on Facebook at Marcus Gillis at Live From Banjo Podcast. And we are now live on Patreon. So please come on over and become a patron at patreon.com/livefrombanjopodcast. And please remember to follow us or subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, and set your reminder so you never miss an episode. So can you tell us what we got our friends in the wrap-up after Jason and I's interview today?
In the wrap-up tonight, we talk about glossolalia.
Glossolalia.
Glossolalia, and speaking in tongues, the School of Rock. We talk about the Peanuts music, Charlie Brown, AOL Instant Messenger, and we uncomfortably cover douchebags.
Am I a douchebag?
No. I mean, you're a lot of things.
It's raining.
Oh, it's raining outside.
Yeah.
Oh, why was that so confusing for me?
I don't know.
No, you're not specifically a douchebag, because we talk about how much I dislike that. I could qualify you in other ways, though. Sometimes. There are moments. And I love you?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We good?
Wonderful. Please enjoy my conversation with the very thoughtful and extremely handsome Jason Pipkin. How's it going, Jason?
It's going good, Marcus.
Good. So you just loaded up the bus?
The bus and trailer. Yeah. We got all our gear, you know, road cases. But then my wife and I, because we bring our son out, also have all the kid gear. So we've got a scooter, helmet for him, car seat, you know, all of that comes on the bus as well.
Right. How's Orion and Rufio doing?
That's my wife right now. He's doing well.
Do you need to take that real quick?
Stop trying to call me.
You can answer it. Put her on speaker.
Well, it's funny. I got the list of do's and don'ts from Squadcast.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, turn off your phone, go to the bathroom. all of these very serious sounding requirements.
Well, I mean, some people are serious. I'm not a very serious person. Depends on which aspects of my life, I guess. Yeah, yesterday when I was rushing home, I had just dropped my daughter off at the airport. That was her first solo flight. The road is closed back to Grand Junction where her mom lives on the other side of the mountain. Mm-hmm. And she took her first solo flight home yesterday.
Wow. How old is she?
She will be 10 in early September.
Wow.
Yeah. And
how did that feel as a dad?
It was pretty terrible. And the only reason why I mention it was because we were driving to the airport and, you know, I was telling her that I was interviewing you. And I said, you know, like they're just such a special band for me because their music has been so uplifting in my life. And it was just kind of one of those stream of consciousness thoughts where you say it and then you're like, I don't know if I should have said this to my daughter after the fact. But I said to her, you know, when your mom and I split up and you guys moved to Grand Junction, I was really depressed for a while. And one of the first times I remember being happy was the first time I saw the Lone Bellow. Oh. And I said, it uplifted my soul for like a week. I was just happy again. And I hadn't really thought about that or had that thought in a while. But yeah, that's the only reason why I mentioned it.
How did she react to that?
She kind of understood. I said, you know, after that, you know, I went back to normal life and it didn't last forever. Nothing does. But no, she's pretty with it for a small person.
Yeah.
Hopefully that hasn't been too much as a result of the damaging things I've done to her and it was just inherent in who she is. But
yeah, right. Every parent hopes so.
Yes. Yes. All we're doing is trying to do the best we can and a lot of times doing wrong. I know my mom was trying really well. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of stuff in my vault where I'm like, that wasn't the best thing ever.
I know. Yeah. I mean, what do they say? You just have to assume your kids will be in therapy for something eventually. Mm-hmm. Just try to make it something that is easier to get over rather than harder.
Yeah. I just think that everybody just needs to be in therapy and then you don't have to worry about it.
True.
Everybody just needs therapy. Mm-hmm. I had a stigma against it for a long time. I had a bunch of crappy therapists. And then I told her, I said, I really hope you don't decide on a career change because I don't know if I can start this whole process over again with somebody.
Yeah, it's so much. I actually applied to school for counseling during COVID. I'm going to go for a clinical mental health counseling degree at some point. I was really in the zone and committed. And then this stuff happened in the spring. We moved house and we started touring again. And I was just like, okay, like still interested, but I'm going to go ahead and finish this album out with the band before I commit myself to going to school every day.
Yeah, I actually was going to eventually bring that up because Kanina mentioned that when we talked months ago, whenever that was. And I was wondering, so you're still in the process, but this is kind of a repetitive theme in your life because you were in seminary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then that was when the Lone Bellow took off. And then you were like, put this on the back burner.
Yeah. Well, you know, to be completely honest, that was part of what was going on with seminary. I think the other part was I started to realize I knew that I didn't want to be a pastor, but I had always thought that seminary would be the way for me to do some type of spiritual work. It was like a stamp of approval. I needed to have a degree to feel validated in doing that. And as I started to go and I learned Hebrew, I read all kinds of books about the Old Testament, I started to realize that I was really interested more in people than I was in growing a church.
Yeah.
And then that kind of took a little bit of the wind out of my sails for seminary. So when the band started up, it was like the perfect confluence of like, would you rather get an MDiv or tour in a rock band for some years? And I was like, I'm going to do the band. The MDiv can wait if it's something I'm into later on.
So because COVID kind of brought out this resurgence in you wanting to work with people, but now coming back to music, how does that feel playing back for people? Do you feel like after this album, you really are going to follow through or you just don't know at this point?
It's hard to say. I think my dream would probably be working from my home studio. You can see behind me, there's many things that I've spent all my money in the world acquiring. And I love to make music. It's just what I do. I love to write songs. and it's hard to earn a living that way. But the dream is always to be doing that. I will be doing that always, no matter what. The question is how much other stuff I'll be doing at the same time. So I'm excited to play in front of an audience again. 2 days from now will be the first time that I've been on stage since COVID.
Okay.
So I'm excited to see how it feels and kind of see, you know, the Lone Bellow is such a beautiful project. And anytime that they give me an availability or say we're going on tour or we're writing an album or we're in the studio, I'll be there if I possibly can. I love Brian and Zach. And of course, my wife so much, and our lives are very intertwined. But I maybe early on, I was a little too entwined in the band without my own realm of whether it's counseling or whether it's making music on the side or my own solo projects and stuff. I didn't have as much of that going on. My vision now is to like be a little bit more diverse in what I'm pursuing.
And kind of mentioning that a long while back, maybe a couple of years ago or so, you and Kaneen were kind of working on some kind of more electronic-y pop record. And this was prior to Orion being born that you guys were planning to come out with. And then I kind of expected it during this pandemic at some point for you guys to put something out. You know, Brian put out Joy Club. He put out a couple of things and Zach finished an album. Did you guys get anything in the can that is in the mixing and that kind of stage of the process during the pandemic?
We wrote a lot. Finishing things is really hard when you do what we do.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in high school and getting into music production, I'd finish the song and then burn it to a CD and be done, you know, and it was out. But now being in a band, I think about PR, I think about branding for a project. I think about all of these like, well, who is this for? You know, like, how will I monetize this? Mm-hmm. Are we going to go on tour? You know, there's all these little questions baked into the professional music circuit that me as an amateur, I was just like, yeah, release that. And now it feels like a much heavier undertaking, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
My goal is Kaneen needs a solo album.
She does.
I am totally ready to produce it. I mean, honestly, the big thing is that we have a child who has not gone to school yet.
Yeah.
So we enrolled him in pre-K this year. So I really think that this fall is the time to finish a solo record for Kaneen and then figure out a release schedule. And then I have about probably 60 songs pretty much done. It's just a matter of choosing which group of songs and how to release it, which is it's kind of challenging.
It is. So as a songwriter in the Lone Bellow, from that standpoint, I know Dust Settles was yours off of Half Moon. Kaneen said that during the process of the last record, you were kind of on the bus and taking care of the kid. And then it would shift over and her sister or whoever, roommate, I can't remember.
Yeah, her sister.
Sister would come in, take over Orion, and then you would go work on kind of little sections of writing. And that was kind of more of your drive in music, was the creation part of it. With what's going on now with the Lone Bellow, where does your creative outlet get to go? Are you still a big part of kind of building some of the sections of the music with the multi-instrumentalist kind of background that you have?
Yeah, that's a good question. The honest answer is I don't know. I don't know exactly how I fit into the bigger puzzle. With the last record with Half Moonlight, I did a lot of pre-production and demoing. So, you know, anything on the last record that you hear and you imagine like that's a little different from how a person with an acoustic guitar would sound doing it. Mm-hmm. That was the stuff that I was honed in on, finding those interesting, unusual parts, finding the vibe. Like Good Times, for example, was a blues song. It had a real like bluesy guitar riff in it, and it was just like sounded like a bar band. And I heard it and I was like, this needs to be Sympathy for the Devil. Oh. We need to put it in the realm of those are the types of things that I love to kind of toss in there, like, oh, how can we make this interesting? How can we make this sound fresh? I will be in the studio throwing those curveballs for this record for sure. But I think the bigger question for me is always just like, how do you serve the band? How do you serve the music that you are entrusted with? It's not about me. It's not about my creative ideas. It's really just about, honestly, it's about the fans. It's about people like you who are hearing the music, who are being affected by it, and trying to do justice to Brian and Zach and Kaneen, who have this powerful thing, trying to figure out, you know, whether it needs a new packaging for this next record. You know, do we do like a throwback to kind of really simple acoustic stuff? Like, I produced that the acoustic EP that came out a few years ago. And the heart behind that was really just like, we've been doing this trio stuff in shows. Let's make an album of it and try to do it in a more sparse, like vocal heavy way. So I always, for me with this band, with the Lone Bellow, I want vocals. I always fight for more vocal. I fight for more harmonies. And I always try to find like the emotion, you know, there. Doesn't matter if there's a cool guitar part, if it's pushing against an emotion of delivery.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite songs of the band is probably one of the most sparse songs in Watch Over Us. You know, I mean, it's just so powerful and yet so minimal.
Yeah. It's such a perfect song. I love that song. And it was one of those songs, like, I think it came to Brian, like, it's one of those songs that came to him in a very short amount of time, if I remember correctly. And so it would have been completely wrong to build that track out with horns and organs and, you know, all this stuff.
Yeah. It sounds like more than the making the other music for you or side projects is you really want to kind of work into more of the producing side.
Sure. Yeah. I love producing. I love producing myself and Kaneen, but I always, it's that human connection, man. It's that finding what touches people, what makes people feel things. That's what I really love. I love playing guitar. I love playing piano. But my very favorite jazz piano player is Vince Guaraldi. And he's the guy that did all the Peanuts music, you know, like the Charlie Brown Christmas, all that stuff. And I love it because you hear those opening notes and you just feel something. Like it's, and it's unusual for jazz players to command that kind of nostalgia. It's just so beautiful. For me, it's all kind of one pot. Producing for me is the same as writing, is the same as singing. The end goal is always taking what's real to me and making it something that someone else can be affected by.
So during the pandemic, do you feel that that was a time of prolificity or where you were writing a lot? Or do you feel that you got the kind of COVID malaise of like, I don't know what to do right now, so I'm just not going to do music?
A little of both. I remember like 4 months in, seeing all my friends' Instagram accounts just saying like, working on this album, it's going to be a great record, you know, like everybody, because there is nothing to do but go in the studio.
Yeah.
It's like the baby boom after World War II. Like you've got these albums coming out right now, / in the next 6 months, you have the COVID boom of records.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, I was like, I just can't listen to another Facebook Live stream of my friend in their living room with a guitar. Like, it just hurt my soul. Yeah. It felt so sad. And it, like, that stuff is real. And it made me think about like, oh, well, yeah, it's so cool to be in this great singer's living room. They're doing these concerts. But after a while, I was just like, it just started to feel like white noise. It started to feel like a little bit less artistic and more just like, we don't know what else to do. We can't go out. Management said I should keep doing these Facebook Live sessions. So I didn't find it an inspiring time, personally. I got to spend all day, every day with my 3-year-old son, which was amazing.
Yeah.
But in terms of like getting things done, completely awash, you know, I would go up in the studio, start working on a song, and he would come up and start hitting keys or, you know, banging on stuff. And it was totally fine. I'd never want to take myself so seriously where I have to be like, get out of here.
Yeah.
Daddy's working.
Yeah, that's always a tough line. I work from my house now as a result of all of this stuff. And sometimes I'm like, to both my wife and my daughter, yeah, I do understand that I'm home. and I want to spend all of this time with you. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I do have to continue to, you know, provide money for this family. It requires me to do this thing that it's not necessarily something I want to be doing. Sometimes it is. I have a couple of jobs, but if it was just interviewing people, it'd be great. But sometimes other things.
I learned how to phrase it in terms of toys for his three-year-old mind. I'm just like, hey, we need to earn money so that we can buy you those toys that you love so much. And then he was like, okay, you work.
Okay.
I'm cool. You know, if it's going to mean more toys for me in the end, then I'll make that sacrifice.
Yeah, my daughter is definitely, she's a smart kid. So she gets it, but at the same time, mentally understanding something and then emotionally being able to deal with it even for myself, my therapist all the time tells me, she's like, you get this.
Yeah.
You get it for everybody else. It's just internally for yourself, you have a real hard time dealing with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's so challenging. My son has really gotten into death lately, asking me a lot of death questions.
Yeah.
And the other day, it was like 8 a.m. He came in to drink some milk and eat some cereal. He just turned 4. And he was like, Dada, am I going to die? I was like, yeah. We're all going to die eventually. He starts crying. And he goes, when I'm dead, I'm really going to miss me.
Oh,
and I was just like,
yeah,
it's like you just explained the human discomfort with loss of consciousness in the simplest terms possible. I was like, when I'm dead, I'm going to miss me. And I was just like, hurt my heart. And at the same time, I was like, what a true idea you just expressed.
Profound statement. Very guru-ish. You know, whether we are really empathetic people or we're caring people or we're really cynical and narcissistic people, we want our lives to be the best most of the time. Like even when we're trying to go out and help other people, we want to feel good, right? I mean, that's this internal kind of selfish motivation for being a good person is to... Yeah. You know, help other people. And it all falls back to us. and so, the only reason not to want to die is because you're not going to miss yourself.
Right. Yeah. And then you try to explain that to a 4-year-old, like,
yeah. Or you feel like you want to get to the place where you want to miss yourself. So you keep trying. So
right.
you need more time around so that you can get to a place where you feel that way.
Right.
Going back a little bit, you grew up in
Fredericksburg, Virginia. Yes.
And was that where you were born or?
Actually, yes. I was born there, moved out to Culpeper, which is about 45 minutes west of Fredericksburg towards the Blue Ridge Mountains. Then moved back to Fredericksburg as a teenager. It's a beautiful place to grow up.
One of my good friends in high school that I'm still friends with is Bear Culpeper. I don't know why that matters, but he owns a luthier shop in Georgia, Southeastern Guitar Repair. Little plug for you, Barrett. But did you have any brothers or sisters growing up?
Yeah, I had one older brother.
Is he still around?
Yeah.
Okay, you had. I was making sure I wasn't getting any phrasing incorrect here.
No, he teaches English now. He got his PhD in medieval literature.
Good.
I think his dissertation was about Beowulf. It was about monsters in Beowulf. Mm. So that's the type of sibling interaction that I'm accustomed to. It's like, you know, tell me about, it's old Icelandic, hard to understand. Like, have you done that kind of research? And, you know, my brother, he's always been in this world of like myths and history. And he has such a strong drive and passion for antiquity.
And you grew up in like... It wasn't a Pentecostal church, was it? Or am I? It was like a...
It was a charismatic church. Yeah. As a matter of fact, my parents were just like normal Southern Christians.
Mm.
And my brother and I, when we were teenagers, started going to this crazy charismatic youth group. And that's where I started playing guitar for real. And I would play electric guitar 7 hours in a go for a worship setting. And it was all improvisation and it was all Holy Spirit. And... it was beautiful. It was a really special time for me. I grew a lot as a musician and as just a human being through that. But because of my brother and I getting so into this sort of Christian mysticism, my parents kind of had to switch their churches and do some things they weren't super comfortable with.
Oh.
They're like, well, what's this speaking in tongues thing? Like, what exactly are you guys doing? But I mean, they're troopers. Hats off to them.
Did you speak in tongues?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I had a friend and his little brother came home from church one day and he was speaking in tongues. And I was like, okay, all right, man. You know, he's like, it's the word of God coming through me. And I was like, sounds good. It sounds like gibberish to me, but you know, like.
Yeah, I don't even know. You know, I went on to study a lot of linguistics. I don't have like a real, it's real or fake. I never really landed anywhere on that. I was just like, at the time, I never felt manipulated into it, but it felt real when mm-hmm. it was happening. But at the same time, I had an element of control to it. And I just remember a sense of freedom, mm-hmm. you know, speaking in that. We would call it like a prayer language.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that when your mind runs out of things to say, when you're kind of talked out with your intellect, you use your prayer language to express like spiritual groanings, you know, mm. like just kind of like deep things that you don't even know how to articulate. And for me as a 16-year-old, I was like, yeah, there's so much that I don't even know how to say. Like, I'll just, you know, just like let loose. And it was a really positive outlet for my overall adolescent angst and energy.
I can definitely relate in a completely different way. I did like the church youth group and stuff and Methodist religion. And then there was some point when I was a teenager when I was like, it was more of that my friends were all these different religions. And I was like, I don't like that, you know, these people are going to hell. That just doesn't make any sense to me. And so I kind of pulled back from the church and I believed in like an overall, there's something bigger, but I kind of pulled away from the Christian faith, I guess, a bit. But the thing that I said that related to me was sometimes I would just get to the point where I didn't know what to say and I would just be driving in my little 87 Honda Civic and I would just scream like,
yeah,
until I was done and I would just laugh.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I got it all out. I don't know. I didn't know what to do with those emotions. So I would just scream.
And the accompaniment, or one accompaniment to speaking in tongues that you see in charismatic circles a lot, is holy laughter. And it is just a room full of people starting to laugh, and then more people laugh and more people laugh. And they say it's the Holy Spirit, but I think it's exactly what you're describing. Like, something needs to come out of me. And when you do experience that release and you're experiencing it with other people and you feel safe, it can be a really wonderful feeling. And I think like John Lennon, the primal scream thing that was happening in the 70s, like it's a similar route, I think.
Yeah. And then I think, you know, that's something that's kind of missing from movies now. We have all this great content and stuff that comes through Netflix or Hulu or whatever it is that you're watching. And one of the things that I used to love about going to the movie theater, like going to see a comedy at the movie theater, you almost never experience something like that anymore, where like it's mm-hmm. like, oh, it's okay to laugh out loud.
Yeah.
I'll almost purposely, when I go to like the movies with my daughter or something, try to like vocalize when I'm happy, just so that it's like, oh, okay, yeah, we don't have to all close into the shell and be quiet all the time and not show any emotion.
And that really brings us back to playing live shows again and concerts. Like for me as a performer out on stage, when I see people shouting and clapping and screaming and singing the songs with tears streaming down their faces, like it's catharsis. And it reminds me of why I pack up trailers and we hire a nanny and take our son out on the road and like do all this stuff. It's just, live music is such a beautiful thing and such a treasure. And I think it's one way that many adults have decided, okay, this is a place where my angst and my inner emotions that I don't necessarily know how to talk about, like it's okay to display them here at a live show.
Yeah.
And this is a place where I receive healing. I receive like camaraderie with other fans. And I just think it's beautiful. I love seeing people just let go in live music settings.
Yeah. I've just gotten back to starting to play live music, going to open mics again.
Nice.
And it's such a weird experience right now for me. I've just taken such a long break from it. And yeah, it's good when people can show their emotion or tell. And then it's good to also just be able to let out my own emotion, you know, and just be able to be like, oh, I'm going to write this in a song and then go sing about this and get some of that stuff that is reeling into my head out into a song and put it out into the world and weight off the chest.
I love open mics so much.
Like, yeah.
I don't know if Kaneen told you, but our first real gig was as open mic hosts in Beijing. And we would host an international open mic. And it wasn't about professionalism. It was about who is brave enough to come up here and do anything, you know, do something, do anything, whether it's good or bad or whatever, just do it and overcome your fears. And it was such a powerful experience for me. I, to this day, you know, I've played Red Rocks, I've played late night TV shows, I've played all over the world, but my favorite musical experiences ever happened at open mic nights. There's just something magical about the equality in the room where it's like, anybody can get up here and do something. We're all in this together. So it kind of completes that circle between performer and audience member, where you are listening to other people and you're ready to go up and give your own, you know, whatever is in you. I just love open mic nights. And I think American Idol has given America an idea that only the best should get up there and do things. Mm-hmm. And that's just not true.
No, everybody should go do it. And the more you do it, I've done like three in the last couple of weeks. And it's just like, I feel each time there's just a progression and my key gets more to where it's supposed to be. And little finger picking on the guitar just gets a little cleaner. And so with you doing your own stuff and you have a lot of your own music and loving open mics, do you ever go to any of the things out in Nashville, or is it just, that is like the epitome of the current like American Idol? You know, I don't want to talk bad about Nashville, but I'm just saying, like, there's a lot of people in Nashville that it's like, don't do this if you're bad at it.
No, Nashville open mics are not real open mics. In a lot of ways, Nashville is the worst city in the world to live in for an open mic.
Yeah, I assumed.
New York was great. There's some great stuff in New York, but still, you always expected you're going to hear like the next big thing wherever you were in New York.
Yeah.
I loved Beijing because like nobody was under the delusion that they were going to hear like the next great international smash hit in the little like student bar there. I'm much more a fan of like small town suburban open mics. You can hear some great stuff in Nashville, and I probably will, you know, as Kaneen and I are developing and working out songs and stuff, I'm sure we'll find some little venues or little, it's almost easier to play like a secret show in Nashville than it is to go to an open mic.
Yeah.
You'll go to an open mic and the list is 40 people long and already full at 4 p.m., you know. But for people like us where it's like, oh, you're in a band, like you want to try a new project, like come play our restaurant or play our cafe or whatever.
Yeah.
That's probably an easier way to do that.
That makes sense. So you said when you were in the church, you were playing electric guitar. Was guitar your first instrument, or were the keys your first thing?
Yeah, I guess keys were. I think I was in second grade when I started taking piano lessons, and I learned by ear. So I ran into this situation where I would memorize whatever the teachers were showing me to play, and I didn't learn how to read the music. And by the time I was 11 or 12, I just really wanted to play the guitar, and I was begging my parents, like, please let me stop playing the piano, please. For Christmas, can I have an electric guitar? And they went to the local music shop and got an electric guitar, like really sweet about it. Didn't tell me about it. On Christmas morning, I opened up the amplifier first and I didn't know what it was. I was an 11-year-old kid and I was like, what's this? And they go, oh, it's a piano amp. It's for you. It's for your piano. And I thought they were serious.
Oh, yeah.
And I just must have looked crestfallen because my dad walked into a different room and like grabbed the black Squire Stratocaster from Fender and handed it to me. And I slept with that guitar for the next 6 months. Like I literally played 7 hours a day. It was just, I was obsessed.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And my first job was teaching guitar lessons. So technically piano is my first instrument, but guitar is the instrument that I fell in love with. But then it came full circle. You know, the older I get, that Charlie Brown music just like hits me harder than anything else, to be honest. During COVID, the one thing I did do was work really hard on my jazz piano. And I just every day playing scales, playing arpeggios. And I told Kaneen, I was like, listen, when we get old and we can't do this like cool band stuff anymore, we're going to do a cocktail lounge like jazz duo and do like jazz standards all over the world. Because when I was in China, that was a thing, like the Hyatt or Hilton or whatever. Oh, yeah. They would have these groups in, they'd put them up, they'd do a tour of like Tokyo, Beijing, Shanghai, Hong Kong.
I was about to say I lived in Tokyo. The Hyatt was really near my campus at my college there. And you could just go there and have a drink and watch the, I think it's that bar that's in Lost in Translation.
Oh yeah, dude, yeah. I love that movie. The soundtrack to that movie is so amazing. Oh, man.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's my retirement plan. Like I want to play cocktail jazz, have nobody listen to me, just enjoying themselves, be the background music for a good time for somebody else.
Well, that's really nice. There's a banjo behind you. Is that a five string or is that a four string? That looks like
it's a five string.
Yeah. What style of banjo you play? Like three fingers?
I do a little claw hammer. I do a little Scruggs style. Actually, if you listen to the first Lone Bellow record, all the banjo parts on there are played by me.
Okay.
On that banjo. And originally, when I was part of the Lone Bellow, I was signed on as a banjo player.
Was that when the band was like eight people long?
Yeah. There were so many people in the band and I was a guitar player. And I was like, man, this was Brooklyn in 2010.
Okay.
Mumford & Sons had just released their debut album.
Yeah.
I was like, man, there's too many guitar players. I need to just learn banjo and play that. So that's what I did. And I played some stuff for the initial release of the Lone Bellow. And when it came time to tour, they said, banjo is cool. What we really need is a bass player. Can you learn upright bass? And I quit my job, spent 10 hours a day practicing upright bass. And after 2 months, we were off to the races. You know, it was just like one of those things that only happened once. And I'm so glad I did it.
But you should have already known how to play the bass because you taught your wife to play the bass, right? It is. My first real instrument was the upright bass. And I would not want to put myself in front of a crowd of people doing that now.
There's a lot of margin for error.
Yeah. So you and Kaneen had met with the Spelling Bee thing, and then you were playing music and you invited her to join the band by teaching her the bass to play with you. Kind of.
Yeah. Well, I was doing like an open mic. It was like select open mic at college. It was called Homebrew. And you had to audition so that the people knew you were good enough to like play a real 45-minute set.
So you were ahead of the, already in the American Idol world.
I was like, yeah, I was like, oh, I can do this. Write songs, check. Play music, check. What I really need is for Kaneen to think I'm cool. And the easiest way to do that is to invite her to play in my band, even though at that time she did not play guitar. So I said, well, you can just play bass. Bass is easy. At the time, School of Rock had just come out, and we were both big fans, Jack Black, and I was like, you can do this. I'll teach you. Let's hang out. This is when I was wooing her.
Yeah.
And so my method of wooing was, let's work on this song together, and we'll like play shows. Kaneen was super into it. So I don't know. I don't know if it was like ethical for me to offer her fame and fortune of a college homebrew show, but yeah, I think it worked.
So with Kaneen, you had known of her at least for a long time. Your friendship was based on you had always had an interest in her from your side? Or was there a friendship point before you realized that you wanted to make sure that she was in your band?
I mean, it was, I knew of her in middle school. We started talking on AOL Instant Messenger. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
Around 10th grade.
Okay.
So it was, I don't know if you've ever seen the show Pen 15. No, it's on Hulu. It's about girls in middle school and they have an episode all about AOL Instant Messenger and like the culture that it created. But Kaneen and I started messaging because me and one of her friends were like maybe supposed to like go on a date or something. And Kaneen was like reaching out or like maybe sort of vetting me. But we like immediately had this AOL Instant Messenger chemistry. We were just like, bap, 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 bap. Like, it was just like we had this, a similar sense of humor for sure, and just like could talk and talk for hours. And even before there was anything romantic, it was just like we just had this human attraction together where it was like we just like being around each other. And eventually, after like, you know, I liked her for a while, and like me, she liked for a while, and I didn't like her. And I like, you know, she broke my heart, I broke hers. You know, we still laugh about who was more in the wrong today. I think everybody agrees that it was probably me. I was probably the bigger douchebag at the time. But eventually it just really, for me, came back to that, like, you know, everybody says like, marry your best friend. And that's kind of where we found ourselves at the end of college.
She's saying, are you off? Are you done?
No, it's freaking Zach Williams sending memes.
Oh, good. Any good ones?
There's one. He says he sent a photo of an iPhone case that has a butt imprint on it and says booty call.
Okay.
So that's the highbrow kind of humor that maybe some of your listeners would be interested to know happens around the Lumbella.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned School of Rock. I'm going to just throw this out, but I haven't thought about that movie in a while. I do remember it coming out. I think I was working in like film production in LA at the time when it came out. But I had a guest on earlier today, and their big thing about getting into music was they were a little bit younger than us, and they saw School of Rock.
No way.
And they wanted to be in that classroom. Like, that's what they imagine. And that was like one of their big drivers for getting into to music was School of Rock. And I don't know if it's the Bader Meinhof thing. I love that so much. Yeah. Yeah. It was great.
Yeah. I mean, that movie was such a, I don't know if you've read Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic, a book about creativity, a book about basically living a creative lifestyle without losing yourself. And she talks about basically how your art should be fun. You should enjoy what you do for a living. And she kind of dismantles the myth of the tortured artist being the only way to go. And I think School of Rock brought a sense of levity to, you know, rock and roll, such a serious thing. Like, you know, famous musicians kill themselves, famous musicians do drugs, famous musicians, you know, this music is dark. And, you know, it was coming off the Marilyn Manson era.
Yeah.
And just to see like a middle-aged man teaching kids about getting the lead out, or, you know, like all these like classic music, you're like, yes, like something really resonated with me. I was like, yeah, music is fun. If it's not fun, why would you do it?
Yeah. Before School of Rock came out, I went to a music school that was trying to do that. And they were just throwing together musicians, you know, like you would go sign up as a guitarist or a drummer or whatever. And then they'd put together these little bands. And
that's awesome.
It was kind of cool. And then the wave, when I joined in there, I think I was 13 or 14. And when I did it, they didn't do the performance for that half of the year or whatever. And instead, they booked us time in a recording studio to record like two songs for the band. We did covers. We did a Led Zeppelin cover and a Nirvana cover in our band, but we got to go and like record and have it
mixed.
That's so cool. And it was a lot of fun, but that was my School of Rock experience.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
We played at a School of Rock in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the kids had learned a bunch of our songs.
Oh.
And we went and watched them perform like three of our songs. And it was the coolest thing. I was very jealous that I didn't have that growing up. I would have loved that as a middle schooler, teenager.
Yeah, no, it was really awesome. And I did realize at that time, I'm like, I am a mediocre guitar player. I'm not the best in the pack. And I just kept playing and playing and playing until now I'm still a mediocre guitar player, but I can do it well enough that I know a couple enough tricks that it makes me look like I'm slightly better than I am. But
I mean, who is good anyway? You know, like there's no, that's one of my big, because I started off as a music teacher, my first job was teaching guitar lessons, but that has always stayed with me, where I really believe that anybody can do anything. I don't believe in natural talent. Mm. I believe maybe more in natural interest. So the kids that I teach, or that I would want to teach, are the ones who are just obsessed with an instrument because they're so interested in it.
Yeah.
And the quickest way to kill that interest is self-evaluation and to say like, well, how good am I? Like, am I like the best in my class or, you know, somewhere in the middle? Like the kids who go far are the ones who are just like, I want to keep playing. I want to keep playing. I like that. I want to keep doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely believe that's true. Yeah. The self-critic in you will kill you extremely fast. It pushed me into making films and journalism instead of being the musician that I wanted to be.
Is that what you're interested in? Like filmmaking and journalism?
No, that was just what I got interested in. I really just loved music. I've been obsessed with music my whole life and went to shows, played in a lot of basement bands that my bands typically weren't making it out of the basement. And then I went off into college. I wanted to be a music producer, and I had taken this class in my senior year of high school where it was called Music Tech, and you basically had a MIDI keyboard, and then projects would be like, all right, you know, pick a video that you're going to write the score to, or like come up with a song, and you had a partner, and you would just write music.
Man, your high school was so much cooler than mine. That sounds awesome.
Well, it was just this one class, and this one, he was the band teacher that was this really cool. He created the class. It came out of nothing, you know, and got it funded and everything. So I just got real into that. And I just loved hearing all the arrangement in my head and being like, okay, and now we can add horns here and we can do this. And so I got into that. And so I had no idea about anything in the music world, but I was like, I should get a business degree, right? Because if you're going to be a music producer, you're probably going to have to deal with the business side a lot. And so I went into school and I was in all the business classes and I was like, I fucking hate this. And I was sitting on the couch one day watching Bottle Rocket in my freshman year of college. And I was like, no, I want to make movies. And so I drove over to the school and changed my degree, and they didn't have a great film program. So I got into the journalism school and then kind of studied a lot with writing and the journalism side of things. And then I went on to film school and did the film school thing, and then eventually left LA and just got really sidetracked. And now I'm working to get myself back into doing things that I'm passionate about. And I had the skills to talk to people and I have a deep music nerd portion of me, and I've played music for the last 30 something years. And that's how this kind of show came about.
That's amazing. Can I ask you a question about music journalism?
Sure.
So, growing up, when it cost $17 to buy a CD, I would read about this album or that album, be like, oh, it sounds like a good purchase. Like, New York Times thought it was great, whatever else. Now, with everything available to everyone for free at all times, like, as a music journalist, if you're not recommending people listen to this album or that album, what are you doing?
I don't know what that's. I'm not a part of that world at all, or that I hope not. Yeah, I have no idea. I guess I consider myself a journalist in that I know how to do the research, but really my show is I try to have conversations with people. That's really what I'm doing. And then I'm hoping that inspirational people that are real people and they just their journey and the different things can give inspiration to people or give another side of what you're looking at. But yeah, I'm not trying to be a music journalist that's out there writing cover story on like, this album is great. I get really angry when I read something that's negatively written about music, because I'm just like, fuck you. That person went out there and put their heart and soul into it. You don't get it. It's not your thing. But I have a real like in my heart, even if I don't like the music, I'm like, you're a dick.
Right. Like, why don't you make an album? I just read the Pitchfork review of John Mayer's latest album. I don't know why. It was one of those things where like it was a clickbaity headline and they totally got me. I was like, oh, that's an album I've listened to. I will read about what somebody else thought about this. Mm. And immediately, as soon as I started reading, I was like, I'm wasting my time right now. Why am I doing this? Why am I reading this?
Yeah.
I just kept going. And at the end, I was like, I did not need to read this guy's opinion of Saab Rock. I probably should have just listened to the record again. You know, like,
is that the one that you and Brian have been kind of posting pictures? Were you a part of this? Were you kept posting these John Mayer pictures on Instagram? I feel like you were.
I posted a photo. I don't know. It makes me feel like a dad. All the dads I know are so into John Mayer.
Yeah.
And it's like, I've embraced it as a part. Like, I've embraced that along with Tevas and doing the laundry. And I ran to the grocery store while we were on vacation to get a gallon of milk. And on the way back, I played Last Train Home, the John Mayer song. I just turned it up in my Subaru Forester.
Okay.
And I was just like, I am a dad. I just welcomed, I welcomed that fact in my life. I was like, I don't need to be cool. And neither does John Mayer. Because look at this record. Look at the way he branded it and the songs that he chose. He's just, he's pushing 40 in the friend zone, was one of his lyrics.
Well, I mean, there was that old thing on the Chappelle show with him and Questlove where it was like,
oh, yeah,
making the white people dance. And then Questlove would come out and start doing a beat and that would make all the black people dance. And it's, you know, it's just part of the genetics. You don't have a choice, I guess.
Yeah, I guess not.
So don't feel too bad.
I love that he has a sense of humor about it.
Oh, yeah. But I remember when my first friend got into John Mayer, I'm like, what? John Mayer? Really? I just don't get it. And he's like, dude, he's awesome. I'm like, okay. Yeah. And then he goes around, starts touring with the Dead or the leftover members of the Dead. And it's like, okay, yeah, I may have missed the boat. I was too cool.
Yeah. I mean, that's the meta conversation about music, right? Is like, what is the difference between good music that means something to you and bad music, or music that you feel neutral about, that you just don't get it? It just doesn't mean anything to you when you hear it. And I think about that a lot as a producer. I think about that a lot in terms of like, what is it about? It's not the sounds, usually, in my opinion. I don't think it's the sounds. I don't even think it's the songwriting. I think it's the branding a lot of times that either grabs somebody or doesn't. And I think it has to do with people seeing a guy or a girl or a band and feeling like, I could be friends with them, or I would like to be them. Something about Justin Bieber is so cool, and something about his ethos, I wish that I was him. And so I'll lower that like drawbridge to let the music into my life. And I think when people listen to music, I think about kind of, it's kind of like a drawbridge a lot. Like, everybody has these defenses where they're like, before I give this music a chance, I need to know that the person making it is somebody that I could respect, or that I want to be or look up to, or comes from the same place that I do. And it, on one level, it seems unfair because you're like, well, just let the song speak for themselves. Just let the music speak for itself. But on another level, it's like, it's just inescapable. When I read an article with an album coming out where I learned that the lead singer's wife was paralyzed and, you know, they had to go to a hospital together. And you imagine that, and you're all of a sudden you're on his side and you're like, ah,
yeah,
Zach, write those songs. I want to hear the emotion because I know that you're a human just like me, and there's something that has connected with me in your story. I don't begrudge that anybody. I think that people should tell their stories and we should read their stories. I think the tricky thing is when you forget that an artist is human and they have a real story. You know, like, it's easy for me to like roll my eyes at Bad Bunny, or, you know, like,
I was going to say, you're telling me I should go back and give Nickelback like another chance, because that was one of those bands that I just put my foot down. And I was just like, no, I'm not in it. I don't feel this, but I have let my doors down a lot for a lot of music, especially as my daughter's getting older. I'm just like, yeah, that's cool, I guess.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, like especially with Nickelback, they became one of those bands that it was almost a sport to like just make fun of them, and like Creed or Smash Mouth.
They became part of that. Them, Mark something that was like the
Mark McGrath from Sugar Ray.
Yeah, Sugar Ray was another one that fell into that.
He's a legend.
Yeah. Yeah. But they were, you know, they were just making their music. Getting out right now and just talking about that, like playing my own music, it's not the music that I love, but it's the music that's coming out of me. And I was talking to Daniel and Lauren Gones, who are a husband and wife duo in a band called Lowland Hum. in Virginia recently. And it's just like, if you don't make the music that comes out of you, then you don't get to make the music. So it may not be, you know, the thing that you want to go and listen to. I mean, as far as, but, you know, it's got to have some kind of connection. Otherwise, you can't be like, I fucking hate this. But, you know, you're not going to make your favorite band's music. You're going to make your music because it's all the things that have churned up. And I keep writing all these songs and I'm like, I don't know what this is, but if I don't go play it, then I just don't get to play anything. So this is what I'm going to go play.
Yeah. That's a great attitude to have.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on. And I know I won't be able to connect with you at the Ryman because you guys are going to be really...
It's gonna be insane.
That's going to be insane. Like at the Ryman headlining for the first time in now your hometown. So I'm not going to try and push for it. But I hope sometime in the future we can get together and say hello.
For sure. No, it's funny. You reached out about the Ryman. I was like, man, I would love if that worked out. How many of my family members are in town? Just like counting the guest list that we have of like hundreds of people who are going to be backstage. And I was just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Ryman is the wrong day.
Yeah. Yeah. I was only going to be in town for a couple of days and I knew you guys were scooting out pretty. I think you got a show like 2 days later. I was like, I don't think they're going to be around.
I think the next day, honestly.
Oh, maybe it is the next day.
It's the Ryman, then Birmingham, then Atlanta.
Were you guys playing in Atlanta?
Variety Playhouse.
Oh, okay. I like that place too. That's a good one.
It's a cool place.
So is there anything that I didn't mention with the promotional stuff going on right now we haven't talked about?
Nope. I don't have anything to plug really. I anticipate releasing some stuff hopefully early next year. Like I said, I want to get that Canine solo album up and running. You can follow me at JD Pipkin on Instagram. It's P-I-P-K-I-N. And, you know, I'll post about upcoming projects from there.
I'd like to have you and Canine back on as a duo guest when you guys get that project up and out in the world. And
for sure.
Do you do the... voices like Canine? Do you just gonna break into like no?
I don't have the vocal agility that my wife has been blessed with.
Okay.
My range is smaller.
Yeah. Sometimes I hear her in interviews and stuff and she just throws out the like funny voices and I was like, I wonder if they connected over that or if that was just her.
No, that's her family actually. Her whole family does weird voices. They're just those types of people.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Okay. So last thing before we go, do you have any sage advice, words of wisdom, thoughts that have been popping around your head that you think would be good for the world to hear right now?
Oh, man. Honestly, as it relates to music, I tell everybody to learn an instrument and play it and enjoy it. Think of the instrument that is most intriguing to you. Maybe it's the accordion. Go out and buy one. You can teach yourself with YouTube. And if you're anything like me, it will be the most rewarding pursuit. I don't believe that there's musical people and there's the rest of us. I'm very egalitarian. I really think for people who are, or even like people like you, who you're very musical, you've been playing music forever, is to just follow what you love. Follow what's interesting. Mm-hmm. Don't think about, can I make a living of this? You'll kill it. If you think about making a living doing it, or if you're good enough, nurture it. Nurture playing what you love. Nurture like finding out how to write songs in a way that when you play it back, you're like, wow, I really feel something. I really captured something there. It doesn't matter if anybody else likes it or not. Like, just do it.
I am 100% on board with that because, you know, I'm 40 now and I don't know if my music career is going to take off or 41 or whatever, but, I have never stopped playing music and I don't know if I would still be around if I didn't have a guitar and didn't have songwriting. Like, I mean, I've written a gazillion songs, you know, and a lot of them forgotten. Some of them are still rattling around in there, but it's been such an important part of my life of just being able to have that outlet. And I preach it all the time to people. Just go pick up an instrument. Oh, I couldn't do that. And I'm like, I will tell you. If I can do it, you can do it.
I taught an upright bass lesson to a 40-something-year-old woman today. I was like, so why upright bass? It was our first lesson. And she said, I went to this show. There was a girl playing the upright bass. She was just dancing with it. And the music was okay, but she was magic. My eyes were just, I was just riveted the whole time. I was like, yes, that's exactly what you need to pay attention to. find the magic in whatever everybody's doing, and rent that bass, buy that mandolin, like bring it into your life. Mm-hmm. Don't think it's for somebody else. It's for you.
I took my wife to her first Lone Bellow show when we were dating like 7 years ago or something. And we were camping and I was bringing my guitar and we started kind of writing and singing together. And I was like, you need an instrument so we can, you know, just go play music together. She saw Kaneen playing the mandolin and she really dug it. So then that Christmas, I bought her a mandolin and she started playing the mandolin that year. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, man, I agree with those words. If you just like music, just go put something in your hands and go do it. So, well, I appreciate your time, man. And look forward to staying in touch. And whether it's your own project or Lone Bellow, we'll keep you coming back on here. Hopefully this keeps going for some years.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for reaching out. I never do interviews, so this is a fun experience for me.
It was one of my favorite ones. So you've got the gift. So just keep doing the interviews. Just keep doing mine. Just once a year, just feel like you got to get it out of your system. Just come over and do my show. And I'm okay with that.
All right, man.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
We were walking past construction, waves of heat by the ocean.
I think we've already decided that in the rules, you can't actually sing a song of the people that you're interviewing.
I know, but I get it. And I knew that I was breaking the rules, but I'm a rule breaker. I've been breaking rules forever. Call it entitlement, call it whatever you want. But Jason wrote that song.
Yes.
Even though he doesn't sing it in the band.
Yeah. And it's one of my like favorite songs.
I know it is. And so that's why I decided.
They also didn't sing the happy birthday song. It was a little disappointing because we were on my birthday trip. And so again, with entitlement, I just felt like this has to happen, right? It's fine. I'm not mad at them. Believe me when I tell you, I am not mad at them. I am happy that they exist, and I'm super stoked that we got to see them last night.
Okay. So Jason Pipkin of the Lone Bellow, holy shit, they're so good.
Oh my God.
I feel like every time I go to their show, I like psych myself down to tell myself they're not really going to be as amazing.
Oh, it can't possibly really be that good. I was in a state that one time that I saw that. No, it's not.
And then they come on stage and I'm like, holy shit, they are that good.
I'm not joking around. I walked in. I am now someone I would consider a sufferer of, I guess, chronic back pain at this point in my life.
I think we can.
We're going on 2 years
yeah.
of me bitching and complaining about this. I swear to God, first song in, I realized, oh my God, my back doesn't hurt. So my glowing endorsement of this band is go see them. They will cure all that ails you. Just watching them exist on stage.
Yeah. And I told you the first time, as you being somewhat of an agnostic or maybe even an atheist, though you don't ever put words on it, which
no,
is fine.
I don't like labels.
Yeah. But I told you the first time that you were going to go see the Lone Bellow that this is a religious experience. Doesn't matter if you have a religion, there is just something that will make you feel connected to the world. And you did one of your normal eye rolls that you give me.
Yep.
And then we got done with the show and you said, okay, you're right.
I'm also, we talked about this on our way to breakfast this morning. I generally exist at a steady 6 in terms of emotions. I am a very steady person. And it's very rare that I get up over, you know, like an 8. Very, very rare that I get below like a 3. I had the full spectrum in such short periods of time last night. Like in the course of a song, I would be sobbing and then laughing, and then like joyful, which is a word that I don't like to use very often because it does describe a state of being that isn't common, I don't think, in just like humans, where you feel that stuff from your chest, like you're like the Trolls movie. It's like bursting out with glitter.
Mirth?
I said glitter.
I know, I said mirth. I think mirth would be like a good description of that feeling.
Okay.
M-I-R-T-H, mirth.
I always thought that that was something that was given by the wise men to Jesus. Myrrh. I think those are two different things. And I am right now old when I realize that. So cool. I'm going to still go with joyful until I have a chance to look that word up and make sure that I'm using it correctly.
All right. For another wrap up, I guess. Okay. So Jason grew up in what he called a charismatic church, which he distinguished from a Pentecostal church. And so I looked up the difference between those two. And charismatics are defined as Christians who share with Pentecostals an emphasis on the gifts of the Spirit, but who remain a part of a mainline church. Also, charismatics are more likely than Pentecostals to believe that glossolalia is not a necessary evidence of Spirit baptism. So we talked about speaking in tongues, and glossolalia is the phenomenon of apparently speaking in an unknown language, especially in religious worship. It is practiced especially by Pentecostal and charismatic Christians. So Pentecostals put a lot more weight on the speaking of tongues than the charismatics, even though they both do it.
Is this common in that part of the country?
It's common in these churches.
I'm literally like here right now in quote unquote this part of the country.
Right, right.
But I guess I don't, yeah, I have no connection to that. I have no understanding of it.
There's charismatic and Pentecostal churches all over the world, but yeah, the South's got a lot of them.
Huh, okay. Yeah, I was sitting in the Ryman last night. There was a moment where I was sort of leaning on their pews. They're not like chairs or auditorium
they're
seats.
They're hardwood pews.
They are literally church pews. And there was a moment where I leaned forward and I was kind of leaning on the pew in front of me. And it's very specific in a church pew, the curve of the wood on the back of the pew in front of you, it's curved that way so that you can lean your arms and put your head down and pray. And because I had my butt on my pew and I was sitting in that position, I almost could feel my mom smacking my lower back in that moment to get my butt off the pew and kneel properly. Because that was a thing that we were very strictly not allowed to while we were kneeling in church. We were definitely not allowed to rest our butts on our pew. It was, oh my God, my mom was a little, like if she had a wooden ruler with her at that time, she would have been smacking her little kids with it.
Well, I think that that is hilarious that that occurred. But I also thought they've never put padding into these pews, you know, maybe keeping it closer to what it was originally, more authentic.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it makes you never want to sit down
at a
show.
Well, I mean, we were seeing the Lone Fellow. There wasn't a chance we were going to sit down anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't going to sit, but I would not want to sit down.
No. Yeah. That's how our church was. Well, I was Catholic. So, of course, our things are going to be as uncomfortable as humanly possible.
Methodist was the same way. It was because you sang a lot. So you're up all the time.
But did your mom beat you during church then?
No, not at all. No.
Well, that was nice of her.
Yeah. My mom never beat me. Anyway, I went looking to see if there was any science on speaking in tongues. And I found a magazine article in Science Magazine called Tongues on the Mind by Constant Holden. And this was from November 2nd, 2006. I'm going to read this little section. For a practice that's been around for thousands of years, scientists understand very little about what goes on when people speak in tongues. Currently, glossolalia, as it's called, can be found in Pentecostal and charismatic Christian sects, where those affected believe they are uttering a message directly from God. Now scientists say they have captured glossolalia on brain scans, which link decreased frontal lobe activity to a loss of self-control. To conduct this study, psychiatrist Andrew Newberg of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia and his colleagues recruited the African-American women who belonged to a local Pentecostal congregation. All had been in the habit of speaking in tongues almost on a daily basis for the last 5 years, says Newberg. As a control activity, subjects stood and sang gospel songs with musical accompaniment, moving their arms and swaying. Then they were asked to repeat the behavior, but this time researchers encouraged them to speak in tongues rather than sing. In each case, the scientists gave the subjects an intravenous injection of a radioactive tracer that provided in effect a freeze frame of which brain areas were more active during the behavior. As indicated by increased blood flow, this was captured by then scanning the women's brain in a single photon emission computed tomography, SPECT, machine. SPECT glossolalia produced a significantly different pattern of brain activity than singing. Perhaps the most important difference was a decrease in frontal lobe function, Newberg says. The part of the brain that normally makes them feel in control has been essentially shut down. Another notable change was increased activity in their parietal region, the part of the brain that takes sensory information and tries to create a sense of self and how you relate to the rest of the world. Findings make sense, says Newberg, because speaking in tongues involves relinquishing control. while gaining a very intense experience of how the self relates to God. Interestingly, he notes the glossolalia responses were the opposite of those seen in subjects in a meditative state. When people meditate on a particular sacred object, Newberg has found that their frontal lobe activity increases while their parietal activity goes down. This confirms that with the notion that in a meditation, one has a controlled focus while losing a sense of self. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
There is something going on in the brain when they're doing this hoodoo, as I like to call it.
Any particular reason that they used the subjects that they did?
Yeah, because these women had been speaking in tongues on all the time for a regular period of time. It's like when you study meditating, a lot of the times they study people that have been meditating for a long time. So they get people that are experts at doing the thing that they're studying. And that's why they got them to sing separately as the control, so that it would be something that was completely different than what their mind would be doing when they were speaking in tongues.
It just seemed like a small sample, I guess.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just trying to find if there was any science to it, and that's what I found.
I'm not criticizing you for the size of their sample. I was just curious if there was some explanation to that. I mean, it's a practice that's been going on for hundreds of years, right?
Yeah.
All over the world.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's what I was wondering, why they pulled the sample of the specific group of women.
Contagious laughter.
Asking questions.
Contagious laughter. We also talked about laughing, you know, because of the speaking in tongues. And so are you ready for some more science?
Oh God, I love science.
Thanks. So this next passage is from an article on livescience.com written by Andrea Thompson. If you see two people laughing at a joke you didn't hear, chances are you will smile anyway, even if you don't realize it. According to a new study, laughter truly is contagious. The brain responds to the sound of laughter and preps the muscles in the face to join in the mirth. It seems that it is absolutely true.
Wait, did you decide to use the word mirth just because you'd seen it in this study? This is not a normal part of your vocabulary, and now I'm just calling you out on it because you made me feel dumb for not knowing what it meant.
It seems that it's absolutely true that laugh and the whole world laughs with you.
I saw this word. I Googled it. I made my wife feel bad for not realizing what she was talking about.
Said Sophie Scott, a neuroscientist at the University College of London. We've known for some time that when we are talking to someone, we often mirror their behavior, copying the words they use and mimicking their gestures. Now we've shown that the same appears to apply to laughter, too.
So this is like yawning. Yeah. Laughing is the same as yawning.
Well, we'll see. At least at the level of...
Almost everyone listening just yawned also, just so you know.
All right, now we've shown that the same appears to apply to laughter too, at least at the level of the brain. Scott and her fellow researchers played a series of sounds to volunteers and measured the responses in their brain with an fMRI scanner. Some sounds, like laughter or a triumphant shout, were positive, while others, like screaming or retching, were negative. All of the sounds triggered responses in the premortal cortical region of the brain, which prepares the muscles in the face to move in a way that corresponds to the sound. The response was much higher for positive sounds, suggesting they are more contagious than negative sounds, which could explain our involuntary smiles when we see people laughing. The team also tested the movement of facial muscles when the sounds were played and found that people tended to smile when they heard laughter, but didn't make a gagging face when they heard retching sounds.
You know what I read somewhere once? That if you're sitting in a crowded place and if you're trying to figure out if somebody is checking you out, that a surefire way to do that is to yawn, and you will know if they were watching you by whether or not they yawned. It seems silly, but also interesting.
I feel that that's from like some rom-com.
Or like a bad advice column, like dating advice column. Like, if you want to know if that boy is checking you out from across the lunchroom.
You're not like a woman who gets mags, you know, like those.
Do magazines still exist?
I don't know if they do.
Like in the world?
Yeah.
I haven't seen a People magazine in a solid...
We get Climbing Magazine.
Years. We do. Not voluntarily. They just somehow decided that we like climbing and backpacking, and those magazines get automatically sent to our house.
That was me.
Oh. I am unaware of things that are going on in my own home.
Yeah. But I have dated women or girls over the years, depending on the age of my life, that have had those types of magazines. And I've definitely perused them or been read.
Oh, yeah.
To.
I would say in my 20s, I definitely subscribed to Us. I would say I bet I was an Us Weekly or People magazine subscriber. And I think there was a time in my life where I subscribed to Cosmo as well. Mm. Not that you would know this by looking at me.
Sometimes you really doll it up.
So. Sometimes I can.
So this all made me think the whole contagious laughter thing. I remember hearing about some epidemic in Africa somewhere where these people, like, this contagious laughter grew and grew and grew. And so I went to find it and I found it. It was called the Tanganyika Laughter Epidemic of 1962. Was an outbreak of mass hysteria or mass psychological illness rumored to have occurred in or near the village of Kashahasa. I don't know.
I'm assuming you butchered that.
Kashasha.
Sure, babe.
On the western coast of Lake Victoria in Tanganyika, which once united with Zanzibar, became the modern nation of Tanzania near the brother with Uganda. Isn't Zanzibar? Zanzibar is a quantum leap later, but we'll get to that. The laughter epidemic began on January 31st, 1962 at a mission-run boarding school for girls in Kashasha. It started with three girls and spread throughout the school, affecting 95 of the 159 pupils aged 12 to 18. Symptoms lasted from a few hours to 16 days. The teaching staff were unaffected and reported that students were unable to concentrate on their lessons. The school closed on March 18th. The epidemic spread to Nishamba, a village where several of the women lived. In April and May, 217, mostly young villagers, had laughing attacks. The Kashasha school reopened on May 21st and reclosed at the end of June. Earlier that month, the laughing epidemic spread to Ramashinye Girls Middle School, near affecting 48 girls. The Kashasha school was sued for allowing the children and their parents to transmit it to the surrounding areas. Other schools, Kashasha itself and another village, were affected to some degree. 18 months after it started, the phenomenon died off. The laughter reports were widely accompanied by descriptions of fainting, flatulence, respiratory problems, rashes, crying, and screaming. In all, 14 schools were shut down and 1,000 people were affected.
There's a lot going on here.
It's fucking nuts is what it is.
You know what? This seems like yet another epidemic that face coverings would probably have helped with.
I don't know. You still hear people laughing. It's you all about hear. The hearing.
Oh, yeah. You said it was triggered by the sounds, yeah. Not necessarily the facial expressions.
Yeah, the sound would trigger smiling.
Okay.
Yeah. So he talked about Garaldi, who created the Peanuts music, was a jazz pianist who was famous for a number of reasons, but most famous for the Peanuts music.
Yeah.
And I just want to note before I talk a little bit about Vincent Anthony Garaldi, there were a couple of leads that Jason took on the piano last night.
Yeah.
And after having done this interview and then listening, oh, that was totally, Walter, go back to sleep. That was totally inspired by Garaldi. I felt like it had some of that flair to it. There was multiple songs where he did. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a Garaldi style lead. I didn't even think about it. Would have never kind of put the two and two together. But really interesting. But he lived from July 17th, 1928 to February 6th, 1976, and was an American jazz pianist noted for his innovative compositions and arrangements and for composing music for animated television adaptations of the Peanut comic strip, including their signature melody, Linus and Lucy, and the holiday standard, Christmas Time is Here. He is also known for his performances on piano as a member of Cal Jadair's 1950s ensemble and for his own solo career. I think that's all I'm going to say about Garaldi. Jason said that he's already kind of prepped his wife that he wants to go work at like a jazz piano bar and be like a piano and jazz singer, kind of like our camp host aspirations for life.
Yeah.
I kind of like theirs better, but I don't have the chops yet. You know, maybe we'll get there by the time we're retired.
I definitely think our retirement plan should remain being camp hosts.
Okay. But I still like theirs too. But the Lost in Translation hotel and bar that I spoke of is the New York bar on the 52nd floor of the Park Hyatt in Tokyo. And we can go see Jason Kanin when they have their residency in the next 25 to 30 years.
That would be amazing.
That would be a good Japan trip.
I think that would be worth going to Japan for.
All right. So we had back-to-back interviews in the same day that both mentioned School of Rock. So I thought that I'd speak about School of Rock a little, which is both a feature film starring Jack Black as a semi-con man that takes over a private school's music program and creates a band of fifth grade rock stars to win a battle to pay his rent. Heartwarming. And I was a fan of Mike Wyke's writing and I love Tenacious D. So I went to see that. That came out in 2003.
Scamming private schools for your own personal benefit definitely is very heartwarming.
Right. And nevertheless,
not to mention taking advantage of small children.
The other School of Rock is the music school that we all kind of know. You see it around in different towns, depending on where you live. And it's a after school music program. They do private lessons, but then they also do these ensemble type training to train up and coming musicians to be able to play in a band.
Did they come about after the movie School of Rock, or did one beget the other?
There's a little bit of a crossover here. So with that, I don't remember what the name of the place that I went to, but it was in Stowe Mountain, Georgia, and they did the same thing back as early as 93, 94. It was not called School of Rock. It was just like whatever music school's little band program. But
that's so, a really long name for a band school.
Yeah. Thanks, Crystal. And,
they should really consider marketing and branding that differently.
I don't remember what the name was.
Probably because the name was so lame. Again, they have some branding issues.
Anyway, I'm saying that I did that as early as 93, 94. The Paul of Green School of Rock Music, which is now known as just School of Rock, officially changed its name in 2010, but he started this program in 1996. So he started this program in 96. I was doing a program like this 2 or 3 years before, had no connection to this guy. So this guy, thinking that he created this idea, I'm like, no, I mean, I was in a program before you started your program. So anyway, Paul Green had been giving individual music lessons in his home in 1996. He invited a group of students to sit in and jam with his own band with disappointing results. By the third week, he found that the students who played in a group had advanced much more than the students who received only traditional solo instruction. He modified his teaching method to supplement traditional instruction with group practice with the goal of playing a show. He compared it to the difference between shooting hoops and playing basketball. He took out a loan in 2002 and he started the Paul Green School of Rock Music. And then 2003, the movie comes out and he feels like they've ripped off his life story to make this movie.
It's funny that he would step up and be like, you stole my life story, when the movie was about a con man who took advantage of young children to pay his rent.
Right.
Dude, just be quiet. You're fine. Take credit for the name of the school. Walk away with a smile on your face.
So he thought about suing, and Mike White's like, I've never fucking heard of you. I don't know anything about your school. Didn't get that. Just came up with this funny idea.
Just take advantage because of the fact that because your school is called School of Rock, you now have this many more people who want to enroll.
That's what he decided on. Okay. And that's what he came out. He decided not to sue. And then he got like schoolofrock.com, bought the web address.
Okay.
And then the thing that was funny was he always called his school Rock School. Like when he answered the phone, like he had never said School of Rock. He had said Rock School. But after the movie came out, he did that. And then 2010, they officially changed and it became a chain all around. And
okay. Yeah. So what I'm hearing from this story is that he is better at branding than the Stone Mountain Random School of Rock program in Georgia.
It sounds like, yeah, he might have something.
Okay, good. Again, they really should look into a better name of their company.
I don't feel like that program lasted for very long because I went to go watch, like my guitar teacher was like, oh, you should go. We're doing this show. It's kind of a cool concept. We're like putting bands together. Mm-hmm. So I went and I watched his performance and I was like, that's awesome. Like I get to like be on stage. And I was like I said, I can't remember. I was either 13 or 14 at the time. And then we did it and like barely anybody signed up. So there was only like 2 bands for the whole program.
Oh, bummer.
So that's why we went in and went to the recording studio.
Yeah.
But which was also a cool experience. That was the first time I ever got to record in a recording studio and kind of watch that process and stuff too, which was fun. I played lead guitar on both tracks. I really wish I had that cassette tape. All right.
I don't know. I have a lot of dance recital tapes from when I was a little young person, and I would say I don't benefit whatsoever from having that material on video form.
I listened to it all the way back as my early 20s. I had it at that point, and it was still funny to listen to because I didn't sing on it. I just played guitar.
Uh-huh.
I had those lead licks, and one of them actually ended up being okay. Like it came out pretty good on the Nirvana track, and
sure,
I was like, the one I tried to just rip off the Jimmy lead from Led Zeppelin wasn't perfect, but the one where I came up with my own lead for the Nirvana ended up being pretty decent. It was the way to go, I guess. Moving on. He mentioned the show Pin 15, which highlighted AOL Instant Messenger, and didn't know anything about it. It's an American cringe comedy streaming television series created by Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle that premiered on February 8th, 2019, day after my birthday. But it's as described as middle school as it really happened. And Erskine and Conkle, who were both 31 years old at the start of season one, play versions of themselves as 13-year-old social outcasts in the year 2000, surrounded by actual 13-year-olds, where their best day of your life can turn into your worst with the stroke of a gel pen. So I'm thinking that it's like actual grown-ups playing their 13-year-old selves.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Amongst children. AOL Instant Messenger, getting to that. A lot of people called it AIM, was a instant messaging and presence computer program created by AOL. It used proprietary OSCAR instant messaging protocol and the TOC protocol to allow registered users to communicate in real time. And we used it in college sometimes, but when I was a freshman in college, I got rid of the pager and got a cell phone. And I was kind of a late getting to really being into texting until I moved to Japan really in 2001. But I just used a phone after that. I wasn't a big AIM instant messenger person. Were you ever into that?
I can't say that I've ever used it.
Okay. Yeah. It wasn't a huge highlight for me. I know I used it a couple of times because I looked at it and I was like, oh yeah, I remember that interface, but it wasn't a big part of my life. And now it has gone to the wayside, and they say in reference to programs like MySpace. And I just wanted to say that because I like to mention
really
MySpace whenever I can.
MySpace.
I love MySpace. So he used the term douchebag, which...
which I would like to go away forever.
So I
really think I have a problem with it.
I think it's funny because there's no real attachment to anything. It's not a highly used thing. It's just like, you're such a douchebag.
Right.
And a douchebag is a bag for giving douches in a rubber douche bag. And this is to put a perfume...
Yeah, horribly toxic chemicals into places that they don't belong.
The female genitalia to spruce up the smell.
Because marketers love to make women feel like we are dirty and gross unless we use their highly toxic fragrance products.
Right. And then, but also a douchebag is just an obnoxious or offensive, disgusting person or whatever. You're such a... You know.
I mean, the concept of douching is noxious and offensive and toxic. So I guess it lines up, but I just want the term to go away. I want it to be erased from history.
I think most, at least males in my generation, came to know what douching was because of that commercial where the mom and the daughter were walking down the beach and she goes, "Mom, do you douche?"
God, I hate everything about that.
Do you remember that?
I do, and I just hate it so much.
Okay.
Like, you guys have all of the insults in the world. That you guys can call each other jackasses if you like. That's fine. That's cool. It doesn't affect, like, my gender at all.
You donkey.
You could call each other donkeys.
Donkey.
You could call each other...
I want some waffles.
Anyway, it could go away forever, and I'd be okay with it.
I thought about that. So when he said the word douchebag, I was like, I haven't heard...
Oh, Crystal's going to have a field day with that.
No, I was like, I haven't heard somebody use that term in a while, and it was just such a ubiquitous...
No, my brother literally used it in our house like a month ago.
Okay.
And I said the same thing to him, like, that could go away forever. Oh. And of course, he doesn't get it.
Yeah. But I just was like, that was such like a common phrase from our group. And so I wasn't trying to attack him for saying it. I just thought it was kind of noteworthy in the fact that it was such like a ubiquitous term that we just heard everywhere. Yeah. And it's much less frequent. And then I was trying to think about, is it offensive in the fact that it's connected to females? And is it something that should be pulled out? That was kind of where I wanted the conversation to go, was to...
Right.
I know that you don't love it, but I didn't know what the where that dislove came from. Like,
you know, I don't know that it's offensive towards females in the way that it kind of is, but more so that just douchebags exist in the world. That it's ever been a thing is what I find offensive.
Yeah, I think it's better than men calling other men that they think are lesser the female genitalia.
Oh yeah, that's a real problem.
Yeah. Like that's kind of where I was going.
It feels kind of adjacent to that.
Yeah, it does feel adjacent, but that's where I was going. I was trying to have that connection and thinking about it, and then I wanted to hear your thoughts on it. Can I give you one funny douchebag story? And it is PG, and it's classic. So,
are you gonna wait for my consent or no? We're just gonna do this. <I'm> okay, we're just doing this. All right.
So my college roommate, freshman year of college, first semester, we went to high school together, and our junior year of high school, he was like soccer star. He was like one of the best people on the soccer team, and he hadn't drank really before. And everybody from my high school is down at Panama City Beach because that's just what you did. You go to PCB for spring break. Mm-hmm. So my whole high school is...
I hate saying this, but that is actually a quantum leap back to one of our first episodes that you and I did together.
Yeah.
We talked about PCB.
It was actually... Brian Elmquist was talking about just having gone to PCB.
No shit, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
funny.
Yeah.
That is really funny. Okay, yeah. Continue. Sorry.
So definitely a quantum leap there. And you just used the word quantum leap.
And I hate myself for it.
So anyway, I run into Matt on the beach, and Matt has this backpack on, and he's got a bladder,
like a camelback.
Like a camelback. He and his friend, I can't remember his name. He was a funny kid. But we happened to be there with some females. And Matt goes, guys, he's like, we found these camelbacks at the pharmacy.
No.
And he's like,
no.
And they were so cheap.
No.
And so he opens up the backpack. None of the males having any idea what a douchebag looks like. And him and this other kid were like drinking booze out of a douchebag walking down the beach.
I'm so upset about this, but also kind of like, because I find all of that so offensive, I'm just like, nope, it's fine. Let it happen. Just let these college boys.
They were high school boys.
Even worse.
Yeah, okay. They were juniors in high school. It was the first time.
Let this just happen to them.
Matt was a kind of a latecomer to the drinking. Well, I mean, for some at 17.
At 17.
Yeah.
You mean comparatively to you. That's what you mean.
That was it. That was all I have.
Holy smokes.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a lot, but.
It was a lot. I did a lot of research.
Yeah.
We had a little extra time, so yeah. I did it.
I believe I said this to you last night. I find a lot of these interviews very, very interesting because we'll call them rock stars for this. We put musicians up on a pedestal of being like these incredible and talented and amazing humans. And then you interview them and it's like, oh, no, you're actually just kind of like a human, this person that is totally normal. And you have all of the imposter syndrome that all of the rest of us have and everything like that. But there have been interviews that you've done where I'm like, no, these people are extraordinary.
Well, I will disagree just because I have a feeling about that with almost everybody that's been on the show. However.
But I like that. Like most of them are just so darn normal.
And Jason seems very normal, but I will tell you, he is strikingly handsome.
Yeah.
And his wife.
She is strikingly beautiful. And she wore this head to toe sequin dress last night at the Ryman. Her hair looked beautiful. She looked so darn glamorous. She was wearing the tallest shoes I've ever seen. I don't know how this woman does not fall over.
If there was like a magazine that put out the most beautiful couples of like folk rock or of Americana or like.
That would be a very strange.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Strange magazine.
Yeah.
We're just going to objectify. We're just going to objectify the people of folk music.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, it's a lesser known list than you would find in most places, but I believe.
It's not a Maxim Top 100.
Yeah. But I think that Jason and Kaneen are on that list. I think we're a good looking couple. and then I see them and I think, you know, maybe if I looked as good as you did, then we would. You know, we'd have a chance.
I don't know. It's a weird thing to compare again. Like you have a thing with comparing yourself.
It's that American in me.
Also, I don't like being drug into this.
Yeah, yeah. It was, I just wanted to make you uncomfortable is really what I wanted to do.
I am super uncomfortable.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Hopefully Jason and Kaneen aren't too uncomfortable and they're flattered. Well, I love you.
I love you. And I want to thank you for bringing me out to Nashville to come see them, because it was a very remarkable experience.
It was remarkable. And we love all of you. And just remember, kid, we're all in this together.